This is the November 1999 edition of Functional Medicine Update, Volume 18, Number 11. This month we bring you a number of items related to inflammation. Side 1 is packed with a variety of topics, starting with Mark Twain and ending with green tea. On Side 2, we will have an extended report on diabetes, which follows our clinician interview with Dr. Vincent Marinkovich, discussing allergy and immunity. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the November 1999 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
A lot of our listeners and those who are starting to be students of functional medicine have asked, what is the ultimate objective of functional medicine? And I think the best answer that we can give to that is that which Dr. Sidney Baker, the recipient of the 4th International Linus Pauling Award in Functional Medicine, said when he talked about functional medicine. He said, maybe this should just be called good medicine because it achieves the objectives that medicine was set out to provide. Those objectives are reduction of human suffering, improvement of function, reduction of morbidity, and extension of the biologically determined life expectancy, lifespan of the individual. As what Dr. James Fries talked about is compression of morbidity and rectangularizing the survival curve, optimizing function by maintenance of organ reserve throughout one's chronological aging process is the objective of functional medicine. But Mark Twain actually said it better than all of us. You know, he was pithy and obviously had the ability to say things very simply, and often complex ideas in simple statements. Brevity and clarity is the best way to get a point across. And so what did he say? He said, good health is more than the absence of disease. Well, that really says exactly what functional medicine is all about in one simple sentence. The absence of disease does not necessarily mean nor translate to the presence of functional wellness. And what we're trying to do is to get an individual to recognize that they can reside within a continuum from the state of optimal genetic tuning or optimal wellness to the complete absence of wellness, which we call death itself. And anywhere within that continuum can be selected by designing the right environment, lifestyle, nutrition, habit patterns, emotional stimulation, psychological support system, spiritual belief system. All these things work together to give rise to the system of factors which impinge upon genes which give rise to the expression of their function. And by the way, I wasn't sure who we should give attribution to that quote to, but supposedly it was Mark Twain. Good health is more than the absence of disease. And actually, that was described in the British Journal of Nutrition recently, Volume 80, page 77, that whole contribution to our thinking about health and healthcare. Well, occasionally, a paper appears in the scientific or medical literature that's one of those papers that just stops you in your tracks. You know that it is something you've thought about for so long, and you just wish that someone would do that study, and it would so help you to be able to better describe and explain and hold on to the concepts of functional medicine. And such a paper was published in the Science magazine, at least for me. And I'd like to share it with you because I think it embodies from a late 20th, emerging 21st century perspective what functional medicine is all about. And this is in Science magazine, volume 285, page 1390 in 1999. It was entitled Gene Expression Profile of Aging and Its Retardation by Calorie Restriction. There are many levels of interest in this paper, and I'll try to hit those levels so that you can appreciate how this might be a glimpse into where we're heading in the new millennium. It goes on to say that, as we know, most multicellular organisms have a progressive and irreversible physiological decline that characterizes aging or senescence. The molecular basis of this process still remains unknown, and there's a big debate within the field of molecular gerontology as to whether aging is a disease or aging is a natural consequence of a winding down through some predetermined biological clock of function. However, we know, good experience in life, this is the rule of reasonableness, that chronological aging and biological aging, although there's an interrelationship function between them, they're not identical. There are people who are chronologically 60 or 60 plus and are biologically 40 or younger. And there are individuals who are 40 or younger who are biologically 60 or plus. So we know that there is a correlation between your age and birthdays and your function, but they're not exactly related. And some people have assumed that that interrelationship is a genetically predetermined factor and there's little control. It's the kind of a deterministic model coming out of the Mendelian view of genetics that crossover frequencies with homozygous and heterozygous and dominants and recessives gave us what we were, and there's little we can do about it ever since, so just take the luck of the draw, live hedonically, and go for the gold and hope for the best. But what this paper really talks about is a different kind of philosophy, and I think it's very interesting. So let me go on and talk about what they say about this senescence process. They talk about the fact that there are a number of postulated mechanisms that are now used in the scientific literature to describe this process of senescence. These include cumulative damage to DNA, which leads to genomic instability, or post-genomic changes. These are called epigenetic alterations, things like glycation of proteins or sulfation of proteins or oxidative damage to proteins that lead to altered gene expression patterns. We also know about telomere shortening in replicative cells, and as the cell ages, it loses those telomeres at the ends of the chromosomes, which then seems to be correlated with biological age and the senescence process. There's oxidative damage to critical macromolecules like membrane lipid peroxidation and the formation of nonaldehyde and other reactive aldehyde materials that can cross-link with proteins to produce damage. That occurs through the reactive oxygen species of hydroxyl radical and superoxide and hydrogen peroxide and the lipid peroxide families. And then lastly, non-enzymatic glycation of proteins that occurs by the combination of glucose or other monosaccharides with proteins across lysyl residues to alter their structure and their function. These are well-recognized molecular events that occur with the process of senescence. And there are those who feel that these are genetically pre-programmed, and you just better hope that you got the good luck of the draw with parents because you're not going to do anything about it. And then there are others that would say, no, there are variables that we impose upon our genes called lifestyle, environmental conditions, stress factors, pollution, which then can modify the rate at which these processes occur. Clearly, two different schools of thought. Genetic manipulation of the aging process in multicellular organisms has been studied in a variety of fairly simple organisms, including the Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly. And the reason the fruit fly has been chosen is it's an organism that's all body wall cells are of the same chronological age, as contrasted to our body, which has differing ages of cells. You know, the skin sloughs off, so the skin actually might be quite young relative to a brain cell or an immune cell that may have been around there since we started on this voyage called our life. So if you study aging in the Drosophila, you've got a kind of a fixed point of chronology, plus the life expectancy of a Drosophila is fairly short, so you can go through the whole of their lifespan pretty quickly. What's been found, as you know, is that the overexpression of enzymes catalase and superoxide dismutase, the copper-zinc form of it, have been found associated with longer life of the Drosophila. In fact, a considerably longer life, suggesting increased antioxidant production off the genes can somehow increase lifespan by decreasing oxidative stress. Another organism that's been studied extensively in aging research is a nematode, C. elegans. It's another very simple animal that, because the genes have been entirely mapped, allows for some fairly good research on the molecular biology of aging. And what's been found with that animal is that there are alterations in the insulin receptor signaling pathways that are associated with aging, suggesting that this glycation and glucose economy and insulin management is very important for regulation for the process of function throughout life, and that dysfunction of insulin signaling can relate to increased senescence. And mutants of the C. elegans who have this insulin signaling process that's disturbed will age much more rapidly. And lastly, there's a lot of research that's been done on stress and its effects on biological aging and the effect that stress in different genotypes has on the phenotype, showing that stress is another modulator of aging. Well, these are all very, very interesting observations. It appears that the postulated mechanisms of action that are related to prevention of biological aging include such things as increasing the DNA repair capacity so that when an individual sustains a damage to the DNA, that there is an increased repair of that DNA. An altered gene expression, improving the catabolic-anabolic balance of proteins in the body for repair. Alteration in metabolic rate. As metabolic rate runs uncontrolled at high levels, that seems to be associated with increased senescence. And as you know, there is a correlation between metabolic rate in animals and their life expectancy or lifespan. With the shrew, which has a very high metabolic rate, it has a very short lifespan, whereas the elephant, with a much slower metabolic rate, has a much longer lifespan. And there is this correlation that's been seen between oxygen turnover, metabolic rate in aerobic organisms, and lifespan. So lots of things seem to converge on this understanding of molecular senescence and how these can be modified through different kinds of diet, lifestyle, environmental changes. In this particular study, which is the one out of Science Magazine I'm describing, out of the Environmental Toxicology Center, the Institute on Aging, and the Department of Genetics and Medical Genetics at the University of Wisconsin, this is a collaborative work with Dr. Richard Weinrich, who is one of the world's regarded experts in the area of caloric restriction and the impact on aging in animals. They took the gastrocnemius muscle from animals and examined the aging process. This is actually the mouse gastrocnemius muscle. That particular tissue was selected because skeletal muscle is primarily composed of long-lived, high-oxygen-consuming post-mitotic cells. This is a feature shared with other critical aging targets, such as the heart and brain. And the loss of muscle mass, which is called sarcopenia, that Irv Rosenberg talks a lot about in his book with Bill Evans on biomarkers of aging, is associated with the aging process and senescence and lowered functionality with age, and it has associated motor dysfunction, and it's a leading cause of frailty and disability in the elderly. So looking at a muscle cell and using it as an aging model is a pretty good selection. At the histological level, aging of the gastrocnemius muscle in mice is characterized by muscle cell atrophy, variation in the size of muscle fibers, the presence of lipofuscin deposits suggesting oxidative damage and the accumulation of molecular debris, collagen deposition, and mitochondrial abnormalities. These are all situations that are found associated with human aging as well. So what these investigators did is to take the gastrocnemius muscle and examine using a molecular array technique the activity and expression of 6,347 genes. And this was the activity of these were surveyed in an oligonucleotide microarray, and 58% or 0.9% displayed a greater than twofold increase in expression levels as a function of age, as these animals aged, whereas 55 or 0.9% displayed a greater than twofold decrease in expression. So some of the genes were turned on, and others of the genes were turned off as the animals aged. Thus, aging process, it seemed, was unlikely due to large, widespread, kind of random alterations in gene expression, but rather more selective alterations in genes being turned on and off. At least the association was quite strong. And as I said, about 0.9% of the genes examined were turned on and about 0.9% were turned off. Now, what does that mean? It means either through a series of conditions that that animal is living in, the genes are expressed in different ways over time, or through some molecular time clock mechanism, certain genes are turned on and off that alter the function of that animal over time, looking at least at the gastrocnemius muscle cell as a model. Of the 58 genes that increased in expression with age, 16% of them were mediators of stress responses, including such things as Heachalk protein, protease, and DNA damage-inducible genes. The largest differential expression between adult and aged animals, which was a 3.8-fold induction, was observed for the gene encoding the mitochondrial sarcomeric creatine kinase. This is a critical target for reactive oxygen species-induced inactivation, suggesting strongly that mitochondrial dysfunction and energy deficits are associated with aging and are related to altered gene expression and the communication between the genome in the chromosomes in the nucleus and that of the DNA in the mitochondrion. So this is a very fascinating kind of molecular support for what we've been speaking to for many years in previously Preventive Medicine Update and now Functional Medicine Update. Looking at the genes that were turned off, 55 or 0.9% of the genes displayed a greater than twofold age-related decrease in expression. Genes in this category that were turned off involved in energy metabolism, 13% of the alterations. These included alterations in genes associated with mitochondrial function and turnover, such as the ATP synthase A and NADPH dehydrogenase genes, which are both involved in mitochondrial bioenergetics. So both from the perspective of those genes that were turned on with aging and those that were turned off with aging, a lot of them had to do with energy dynamics in the mitochondria, which alters mitochondrial function, increasing mitochondrial oxidative stress, shifting the cell redox more towards an oxidative biochemistry, and then creating cell membrane permeability changes and signaling transduction changes and intercellular communication changes, which then has a widespread effect not only on that cell, but potentially on adjacent cells, tissues, and organs. A decrease in the metabolic activity is suggested through the decline in the expression of genes involved in glycolysis, glycogen metabolism, and glycerol phosphate shunt activity, as we're seeing in this result as well, as they were turned down. Aging was therefore characterized by large reductions, twofold or more, in the expression of biosynthetic enzymes, including squalene synthase, which is a fatty acid and cholesterol biosynthetic pathway, steroyl coenzyme A, desaturase, which has to do with the synthesis of polyunsaturated fatty acids that go into membrane composition and structural aspects of the cell and maintain that kind of liquid crystal nature of the cell so they can function as a transducer. So we're seeing a lowered propensity towards the formation of the appropriate elongated desaturated fatty acids, all occurring as a process of this biological or chronological aging. Now, that's a very fascinating story. I hope you get the drift of what I'm saying. There might be a lot of molecular biology ease in that discussion, but the takeaway is that over time, the gastrocnemius muscle of these animals expresses different genetic expression of the genomic potential so that the phenotype starts looking more like an energy-deprived, higher oxidant stress, lowered structural integrity system than it was in the younger animal. Now, what they did is they asked, could we modify the expression of these genes by an environmental condition or a dietary condition? Now, isn't that the question that we in functional medicine have asked so many times? Can you take these predetermined, pre-programmed genetic characteristics and turn them on and off based upon different things that you elect to do in your life? Well, that's what they did to these mice, except the mice didn't have free will. They imposed this sanction on the mice. And what they did is they used a calorie restriction, which is, as you know, in mice and rats and several other species of animals, the only definable nutritional therapy that has really been demonstrated to increase lifespan in these animals. So they fed these animals 76% of their normal calories. And they started this at a point, so it was a modest calorie restriction, but not nutrient restriction. They still got full nutrition in the form of micronutrients, but they restricted the calories slightly, about a 24% calorie restriction. And they initiated this after the animals had already arrived at adulthood. They were no longer pups or weanlings. And they kept them on this program of caloric restriction for about 30 months. Obviously, they had a control group of animals to compare to. Of the largest age-associated alterations, twofold or larger, 29% were completely prevented by caloric restriction and 34% were partially suppressed, meaning what they had seen in the normal aging of animals given ad-lib diets, this turning on and turning off of genes that was associated with biological aging, 29% of those were completely prevented by putting them on a caloric restricted diet. And 34% were partially modified, meaning over half of the changes that occurred in their gene expression with aging were modified towards juvenile animals by putting them on caloric restriction, 24%. Now, this is very, very interesting. Caloric restriction induced a metabolic reprogramming characterized by a transcriptional shift towards energy metabolism, increased biosynthesis, and protein turnover. It results in the induction of 51 genes as compared with age-matched controls consuming the control diet. 19% of the genes in this class are related to energy metabolism. It's like re-nourishing the mitochondria. We call this mitochondrial resuscitation, taking the load off the mitochondria, reducing the oxidative stress on the mitochondria. They also found that transketolase, and some of you know that enzyme, it's a thiamine pyrophosphate vitamin B1 requiring enzyme, very important for controlling an unoxidative branch of the pentose phosphate pathway that produces NADPH that's used for biosynthesis and reducing power for several antioxidant systems. So it's part of the regeneration of the antioxidant support and redox control of the cell. They found that calorie restriction was able to improve transketolase activities, inducing transcripts associated then with NADPH biosynthesis. It also induced transcripts associated with fatty acid metabolism, such as fatty acid synthesis and the peroxisome proliferated activated receptor delta, a mediator of peroxisome proliferation. Caloric restriction may even act to increase insulin sensitivity through the induction of the glucose-dependent insulotropic polypeptide and the PPAR gamma, which is known to be a potent insulin sensitizer. So that may explain why modest calorie restriction in type 2 diabetics can often significantly improve their insulin sensitivity. I'm just adding one little tidbit that's not been clinically shown by this study, but it's certainly provocative. What can we take away from this? Well, calorie restriction had a variety of interesting impacts. It turned on and normalized genes towards the direction that was associated with lowered biological age. It seemed to improve functionality at the metabolic level in these animals. By the way, it also lowered the expression of various detoxification enzymes like cytochrome P450-3A and cytochrome P451-B1. This may be a consequence of the lowered load of toxic metabolites that are necessary to be detoxified, which then also lowers the detoxification oxidative stress, because remember we've spoken at length, when you turn on genes that are involved with detoxification and enhance detoxification process, you're also producing in the liver and other tissues where detoxification is occurring, like the GI mucosa, you're increasing oxidative stress, because that cytochrome P450 pathway is a monooxygenase pathway that produces an oxygen superoxide that can be dismuted into hydroxyl radicals. So by lowered calorie intake, there was a lower detoxification need, and there was a lower expression of these detoxification enzymes. So taken as a whole, what do these results suggest? The authors suggest that these results provide evidence that during aging, there is an induction of a stress response as a result of damaged proteins and other macromolecules that are a consequence of the buildup of toxic metabolites. Does this theme sound familiar to you who have been listening to Metabolic Update, Preventive Medicine Update, and now Functional Medicine Update for the last 17 years? Yes, this is a theme that we have been speaking to. It's been a constant vector that has been traveling through this program all these many years. This response ensues as the system required for the turnover of such molecules declines, perhaps as a result of an energetic deficit in the cell at the mitochondrial level that's associated with biological aging. In particular, the observed alterations in transcripts associated with energy metabolism and mitochondrial function may reflect either decreased mitochondrial bioenergetics or turnover secondary to cumulative reactive oxygen species-inflicted mitochondrial damage. So we're not sure if it's a push or a pull, if it's a cause or an effect, but it's all interrelated one with the other, that the ultimate outcome is oxidative damage and lowered energy efficiency with a shift towards oxidative biochemistry. This lends support that one of the principal dysfunctions in rapid senescence is mitochondrial dysfunction, and it plays a central role in the aging of post-mitotic tissues. Indeed, aging is characterized by an exponential increase in oxidatively damaged proteins, and therefore this concept of the buildup of toxic byproducts of metabolism and how that influences oxidative chemistry is very similar to the theme that Dr. Denham Harmon told us some 39 years ago when he talked about free radical aging. We've come a long way in understanding the gene relationships to that and the antioxidant-oxidant balance. Lastly, I should point out that this shift that appears with senescence in expression also, from that ensues insulin resistance and disinsulinism. A hormonal trigger for this shift may be the alteration in the insulin signaling pathway through increased expression of genes that mediate insulin sensitivity. This may link, obviously, the findings in this study with the mouse gastrocnemius muscle with that seen in the nematode C. elegans, where insulin was found to be a fundamental crossover link with aging in that animal. I think out of this comes a very, very interesting molecular biological, molecular genetic understanding or explanation, or maybe it's just a step along the path of understanding of how senescence occurs and how possibly various lifestyle, environmental, nutritional factors can play a role in modulating gene expression and altering then the risk to premature aging. Now, some of you got the good luck of the draw. You got parents that somehow gave you genes that were pretty resistant to environmental abuses that would be engaged in the altered expression of your genes so that that would shift towards a phenotype of premature aging. Others of us, however, may have gotten genes that are much more sensitive to environmental perturbation factors, diet, lifestyle, cigarette smoking, lack of exercise, high stress. And as a consequence, we become biological markers of that process, or we're our own internal biomarkers of senescence as our genes are turned on and turned off in response to those stimuli. And so again, it comes back to matching the individual program with that individual's own genotype. And that's the future as we move into the new millennium of what I think molecular and functional medicine will be looking like and how it will be applied. This obviously is a theme that will be carried forward very nicely in our 7th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. And I know I spoke to this last month, but let me give you another reminder that coming up in May of the year 2000, we will have our 7th International Symposium. It'll be in a beautiful 5-star resort, as they have all been. It'll have a headlining stellar list of presenters internationally recognized, and our focus will be on the impact of energy in functional medicine, both from a molecular metabolic energy perspective and from a non-ionizing radiation perspective, electromagnetic energy, and how it influences functionality throughout one's lifespan. So I think that those of you that have been attending previous functional medicine symposia, you will not be disappointed, I think, with the quality of the year 2000 May symposia. And those who have not come to one, I think this might be the place to start. We'll be getting out information to all of you in the form of a brochure, but please hold that week in mid-May. There is limited access as our symposium has grown in popularity. I want to make sure you as the first read, get that on your calendar. Well, what have we spoken to beyond these molecular genetic characteristics of aging, the modifiable redox potentials and the membrane phenomenon, how essential fatty acids play a role? We've also talked about things like chronic inflammation and its interrelationship with age-related dysfunction. And I was very fascinated to see two recent papers in the literature, both authored by Dr. Paul Ridker and his colleagues at Harvard Mass General. The first was in the Annals of Internal Medicine, Volume 130, page 933 in 1999, entitled Evaluating Novel Cardiovascular Risk Factors, Can We Better Predict Heart Attacks? And in this particular paper, he moves beyond the cholesterol hypothesis for the etiology of heart disease into the newly emerging, or I would have to say re-emerging, because Virchow talked about this in the 18th century, the re-emerging view that heart disease is a consequence of inflammation. And in this particular paper, he describes a variety of tests that might be useful for evaluating these other extended risk factors to heart disease that interrelate with inflammation or with oxidative stress, including such things as lipoprotein A, total plasma homocysteine as a measurement of folate cycle defects, C-reactive protein, particularly what he calls high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, because analytical labs can use two methodologies. The traditional methodology, when you get CRP levels done in the plasma, are low-sensitivity and will not show the discrimination or the precision that you need in order to pick up these cases on the border. The high-sensitivity CRP measurements, however, are able to start picking up some of these chronic inflammatory processes that are interrelated with increased risk to coronary heart disease. And he goes on and talks at some length about these potential markers for vascular occlusion, things like fibrinogen and homocysteine, going on into looking at C-reactive protein as an inflammatory marker, doing some very interesting correlation diagrams to see how effective the high-sensitivity C-reactive protein is in picking up occult heart disease. It would not necessarily be picked up by cholesterol and HDL or LDL subfraction analysis. I think he goes on to say that the cost and relative efficacy of various of these techniques are still under investigation, but there is more and more evidence supporting their value in clinical medicine, particularly in families where there's a history of heart disease of unknown etiology. An individual has started to show symptoms of hypertension, insulin dysfunction, and interrelationships to heart disease risk, then in these cases, looking at these inflammatory markers would be considered desirable. So high-sensitivity CRP, lipoprotein little a, total plasma, homocysteine, and fibrinogen, other accessory cholesterol-independent risk factors for picking up maybe those 50% of individuals that die prematurely to heart disease who do not have high cholesterol levels well before the endpoint is death itself. In a companion paper that appeared more recently, again, this is out of Ridker's group at Harvard, Brigham and Women's, and Mass General, this is entitled Long-Term Effects of Pravastatin on Plasma Concentration of C-Reactive Protein. This is a very additionally interesting paper. This appeared in the journal Circulation, Volume 100, page 230, 1999. In this paper, Ritker and his colleagues point out that elevated plasma concentrations of high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, which we know to be associated with increased cardiovascular risk, can be lowered or associated to be lower when a person is put on a cholesterol-lowering program with a statin drug, which tends to suggest that there's an interrelationship between cholesterol and inflammation. Now, the mechanism of this is still somewhat speculative. However, I think you can see that although this is a cholesterol-independent risk factor at the gross level, possibly at the molecular level, there is a tie together between how cholesterol responds under conditions of inflammation, cholesterol biosynthesis, cholesterol release from various white blood cells, and the whole dynamics of the arterial wall. And therefore, cholesterol itself may be in part the effect and not the cause of heart disease, and there may be underlying shifts in oxidative chemistry and inflammatory markers and cell proliferation, the ICAMs, the intercellular adhesion molecules that predispose to heart disease, change membrane cell receptivity and permeability to ions like calcium, and create then increased gene expression of regulatory intermediates that are associated with the oxidative shift, like NF-kappa-B, nuclear factor kappa-B, and the dissociation of it from inhibitory kappa-B to give rise to a more oxidatively prone mitochondrion. Again, I'm trying to show you that these mechanisms coalesce and converge across a wide range of diagnostic disease codes, these fundamental mechanisms of age-related chronic disease that are starting to emerge. And chronic inflammation is certainly one of those that we should keep our eye on, and there are new markers for it which can be helpful, including the high-sensitivity CRP. Now, as you know, in the inflammatory area, we've seen a tremendous interest surrounding the new medications that are called the selective COX-2 inhibitors, cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitors. And as you recall from previous discussions in Functional Medicine Update, there were two isoforms of cyclooxygenase. There's a cyclooxygenase 1, which is a constitutive form of cyclooxygenase, and there's a cyclooxygenase 2 that's inducible. And what has been said is that when you use a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, you non-selectively suppress the expression of both the inducible and the constitutive form of cyclooxygenase, which reduces immunological potential and can lead to the gastric inflammation and irritation and permeability that's associated with NSAID gastropathy. And therefore, new medications that are selective COX-2 inhibitors that only inhibit the inducible form but not the constitutive form allow maintenance of gastrointestinal integrity while still inducing appropriate uncoupling of the arachidonic acid cascade and pro-inflammation. That all sounded well and good, didn't it? Well, it did so until recently, even though Celebrex is the number one drug growing in popularity in the history of pharmaceuticals. It's actually beaten Viagra, believe it or not, which shows the amount of chronic inflammatory pain that's out there and the relative interest there is in ways of lowering pain due to inflammation. And it's the number one rapidly growing drug in the history of the pharmaceutical industry. And so everything was looking pretty good. You know, the advertisements were selective COX-2 inhibition, get all the good without the bad, new super aspirins, they were called, all sorts of nice things were coming out about it, and the consumer was loving the drug, and the $3.50 a day to take the medication seemed small in comparison to the benefit with very little risk. And then, of course, as we have seen so many times, now starts to come out some of the other things we should keep our attention to in this area. And I'm now talking about the paper by Newberry, Stenson, and Lorenz. These investigators from the Department of Internal Medicine, the Division of Gastroenterology, and the Center for Immunology at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis have recently published in Nature Medicine an article that has the scientific medical community kind of standing on its ear, entitled Cyclooxygenase 2-Dependent Arachidonic Acid Metabolites Are Essential Modulators of the Intestinal Immune Response to Dietary Antigen. Well, what does that mean? Sounds like COX-2 might be important, right, for the protection of mucosal integrity against epithelial transport of large molecules like dietary antigens from the gut into circulation that could activate the immune system. Intestinal inflammatory diseases are mediated by dysregulated immune responses to undefined luminal antigens. When you feed hen egg white lysosome to mice expressing a transgenic T-cell receptor that recognizes the hen egg white lysosome, it results in no intestinal pathology. However, when you simultaneously administer a selective COX-2 inhibitor, one of these new class of drugs, and then give the dietary administration of the egg white protein, it results in increased proliferation of the lamina propitia, mononuclear cells, and crypt epithelial cells. It causes crypt expansion and villus blunting. The mononuclear cells produce high levels of cyclooxygenase 2-dependent arachidonic acid metabolites, which act as immunomodulators in the immune response to dietary antigen. Therefore, taking COX-2 selective inhibitors may, and I want to emphasize may, blunt the immune protection that the gut provides against dietary antigens, increasing the risk then to antigenic response to the diet. Well, that's an interesting observation. Certainly some of the early stage clinical reports would suggest in some individuals that this may be the case. They have expressed sensitivity to foods that were previously tolerant to. So we don't have a lot of bad molecules in our body and a lot of good molecules. We have a milieu of molecules that in balance produce the appropriate function. And by suppressing one class of molecules without control and feedback, it may then induce an imbalance, which then produces an untoward effect. So just for the sake of your understanding, the COX-2 promotes gut tolerance, and by blunting COX-2 or inhibiting it, it may, and I want to emphasize may, cause lowered tolerance of the gut to dietary antigen, increasing then food intolerance reactions. And this is going to be, I think, very important as we listen to this month's Clinician of the Month, Dr. Vincent Marinkovich, who, as an allergist and immunologist and pediatrician, will talk to this whole field in greater detail and the clinical implications of it. But certainly in individuals who have a propensity towards certain food sensitivities, maybe a selective COX-2 inhibitor drug might not be in their best interest. And this is actually discussed in a recent editorial in Nature Medicine, page 867 in volume 8, 1999, talking about food antigens and its increased potentiation of pro-inflammatory cytokines as a consequence of blocking COX-2 with a selective COX-2 inhibitor. What do we know about modulation of immune inflammatory reactions? We know that there are at least two very common nutrients that play a role in gene expression and regulation of this inflammatory pathway, one of which is the omega-3 fatty acid family, the alpha-linolenic acid, eicosapentaenoic, and docosahexaenoic acid, or EPA and DHA families, and the other is vitamin E. A recent paper was published, which I found very interesting. This was in The Lancet, volume 354, page 447 in 1999, in which they looked at dietary supplementation with omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin E after myocardial infarction, asking, was there any help in supplementing with these nutrients? In this particular study, they used 1 gram daily of omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids as a mixture from fish oil and 300 milligrams daily of vitamin E. That's about 400 IUs of natural vitamin E. Treatment with the omega-3 fatty acids, but not vitamin E, significantly lowered the risk of primary endpoint in this particular study. Benefit was attributable to a decrease in the risk of death, 14%, and cardiovascular death, 17%. The effect of the combined treatment was similar to that of omega-3 alone, suggesting that omega-3 had the real benefit and that vitamin E was of little benefit in this particular study with individuals that had previous myocardial infarction. The interpretation of the data is dietary supplementation with omega-3 fatty acids leads to a clinically important and statistically significant benefit, whereas vitamin E had no benefit in the study. Its effects on fatal cardiovascular events require further explanation. That's always the add-on that we have, isn't it? Wait for more data type of admonition. So do vitamin E and fish oil protect against ischemic heart disease, goes on to say the editorial. And, of course, there's a wide, wide range of data on this topic and still no clinical protocol that would recommend EPA supplementation or vitamin E in patients with heart disease. But yet the data continues to mount, indicating the benefits of both these nutrients for management of vascular dynamics, reduction of oxidatively damaged LDL, and decreased atherogenic process. So my thought is, as long as you're following coagulation parameters in individuals that may have been put on various kinds of medications that modify coagulation parameters, looking at the effect of vitamin E and EPA certainly is not outside the range of reasonableness based upon the wide range of literature that's available over the last several years in human clinical trials in these areas. We also know that antioxidants shift the redox balance in cells, and that can cause different cell signaling, and particularly related to the expression of oncogenes or other regulatory cell signaling factors associated with oncogenesis. This was pointed out in a recent paper in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Volume 91, page 1227 in 1999, in which they looked at the effect of antioxidants of vitamin E and vitamin C on androgen-induced gene expression of a protein called AP1, which is part of this redox balance system of nuclear transcription factors, and NF-kappa-B, nuclear factor kappa-B binding, in prostate carcinoma cells. This study was quite interesting because they found that vitamin C and vitamin E in this cell culture study blocked both androgen-induced DNA binding activity and the production of reactive oxygen species in prostate carcinoma cells. Physiological concentrations of the androgens are known to induce production of reactive oxygen species and cause prolonged AP1 and NF-kappa-B DNA binding activities and expression, and these are diminished by vitamin C and E, which may tie together with some of the epidemiological evidence that indicates that vitamin C and E are important in reduction of incidence of prostate cancers. We're starting to uncover or unravel the molecular mechanisms that tie back to gene expression and cell signaling processes and cell regulation as it pertains to these nutrients and antioxidants like vitamin C and E. What about other phytochemicals in cells like soy genistein? And we've certainly talked extensively about the isoflavones that are present in soy over the last several years. But another interesting paper in this same area in the journal Nutrition and Cancer, volume 34, page 12 in 1999, talks about the fact that genistein induced cell cycle arrest in the cell differentiation and division and apoptosis in head and neck squamous cell carcinoma cell lines. Again, this is a cell line study, I want to emphasize, not a human clinical trial. But it showed that there's something about cell signaling and the relationship that genistein has to it and turning off and turning on genes that are associated with cell replication associated with carcinoma that seems very, very interesting. So there are substances within foods that can speak to our genes. Or to say it another way, food has information. Food has information, and that information can speak coherently to our genes or discoherently, incoherently, and produce dysfunction by turning on and turning off certain genes that are associated then with a new phenotypic state that is associated with a different functional health outcome. The model seems to emerge with each passing month with greater understanding as the smoke starts to clear. What about the epicatechin gallate constituents that are found in green tea? Another very highly studied nutraceutical, so to speak, that seems to have powerful benefit in chemo prevention. A recent paper, again, in the journal Nutrition and Cancer, volume 34, page 83 in 1999, looked at the consumption of green tea in humans, and they were able to demonstrate a rapid increase in plasma antioxidant power by looking at the so-called FRAP test. This is the FRAP assay, the ferric reducing antioxidant power. This is similar to the ORAC test, the oxygen reducing absorbance capacity, looking at the total plasma antioxidant potential. And what they found is that by consumption of green tea orally each day, there was an increased antioxidant potential in the plasma, shifting the what you call antioxidant reserve, to steal from the concept organ reserve, the antioxidant reserve. This increase in turn may associate itself with lower damage to DNA and may be associated with the epidemiological observation of a decreased risk to cancer or decreased incidence of cancer in individuals who consume green tea polyphenols, the epigallocatechin gallate. So I think that we're starting to see emerge as we move into the dawn of the new millennium a very interesting paradigm that was first born out of the thinking of Dr. Linus Pauling back in the 1930s and 40s, this whole molecular medicine concept, and is now starting to really mature into a place that can be looked at both from an assessment procedure and from an intervention procedure, where the match between the patient's need of their genes to be properly expressed and what they're doing is achieved. You know, we talked a little about the tetrahydrofolate cycle and hyperhomocysteemia. I should mention to you just in passing, there's a wonderful review in the Annual Reviews of Nutrition, Volume 19, page 357 in 1999, This is a paper by Dr. Robert Russell, who I really admire his contributions at the Human Nutrition Center on Aging at Tufts University in Boston. A gastroenterologist is doing a lot of work in this area, and he looks at vitamin B12 deficiency in the elderly, a topic that we have had a lot of discussion on in Functional Medicine Update. And what does he come to as a conclusion? Again, there's a lot of subacute or chronic vitamin B12 insufficiency, not seen as low plasma or serum B12 levels, not seen as a positive Schilling, but showing itself at the molecular level as increased methylmalonic acid or homocysteine levels in the urine, and that this is associated then with increased problems with cognitive function in the individuals, increased risk to stroke, increased risk to heart disease, possibly even increased risk to cancer. And therefore, functional vitamin B12 deficiency in the elderly is much more common than probably we recognize because we don't ask the right questions. We don't measure serum or urinary methylmalonic acid. We don't measure homocysteine concentrations in the serum. And as a consequence, we don't get the information that would allow us to make good clinical judgments on what that person needs in the way of B12, folate, B6, and betaine supplementation. So they become a Kilmer-McCulley risk factor to hyperhomocysteemia. And as you probably saw in The Lancet recently, it's been found that you don't have to give intramuscular injections of B12 for many of these individuals, that sublingual therapy of cobalamin or even high-dose oral therapy can be an alternative to parenteral cobalamin supplementation. This was a very interesting paper in The Lancet, volume 354, page 740 in 1999, showing that if they gave high-dose sublingual vitamin B12, they were able to show increased plasma levels and increased activity of vitamin B12. So it may not require intramuscular injection. Well, that's it for Side 1. Let's turn to Side 2 for continuation of this month's Functional Medicine Update.
Well, once again, we're here at our most looked forward to portion of Functional Medicine Update, that section that we call Clinician of the Month. We're so fortunate over the last several years to have really some of the premier clinicians to talk to us about areas of their interest and expertise. We're not going to be disappointed this month. Our Clinician of the Month this month is Dr. Vincent Marinkovic. Dr. Marinkovic was evaluated at our 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Tucson, Arizona in May of 1999 by the nearly 600 doctor attendees as being one of the top-ranked speakers in an array of presenters over the 3.5 days of the symposium that were quite impressive. And so that says something about his both clinical acumen, experience, and presentation style. To give you a little insight into Dr. Marinkovic, he got his BS in physics from California Institute of Technology and then went on to get his MD in Harvard. He is a specialist both in pediatrics and allergy and immunology, is in private practice in allergy and immunology in Redwood City, California, and is a clinical associate professor at Stanford Medical School, where he has been there since before 1982, I believe. So he has a very stellar background and I think would be the kind of doctor that if you had an allergy or an immunological problem, you might want to seek out the care of. So, Dr. Marinkovic, welcome this morning. And we hear a lot of debate about allergic-like reactions to food. Not too long ago, we had the chance to talk to Dr. Dean Metcalf at the National Institutes of Health, an expert in this whole area of clinical immunology, and he said that only about 2% of the population have true food allergy, yet we see a lot more percentage than that with people who have atypical reactions to food. Could you help us to understand a little bit about why allergists say there's such a low prevalency of food allergy, but yet we see so much clinical food-related problems?
Yes, I can. Generally, allergists accept, by definition, only those cases of food allergy where there's a definite demonstrable, and generally demonstrable under double-blind controlled conditions, of the presence of IgE antibody. Now, IgE antibody is the same one that causes people to have allergies to their pet cat or to the pollen in the air during certain times of the year or to house dust. That's a subgroup of the population probably numbering, at least as far as significant allergic disease goes, to about perhaps 20 to 25% in our modern society. Of that group, if one excludes everyone except people who specifically are reacting to their foods via an IgE mechanism, that's the antibody that's involved, you find that adults number, it will number about 2%. In children, that number rises to between 4 and 5%, but in adults, it's 2%. I feel from my own clinical experience that the immune system plays a far greater role in producing symptoms in patients from the food they eat, but these patients are not identified by skin testing, which is the traditional testing procedure that traditional allergists use in making their diagnoses. The answer to the question is yes, Dr. Metcalf is correct. I accept his figures for IgE-mediated adverse reactions to foods, but I would add by far the great majority of food reactions are mediated by other than IgE mechanisms, and many of them are mediated by other immunological mechanisms, which could fall under the category of allergy, except that by definition, allergists want to exclude those, and I call them hypersensitivity food reactions.
Could you tell us a little bit about the assessment of hypersensitivity food reactions as contrasted possibly to the IgE-mediated traditional food allergy? How does one as a clinician get a handle on that problem?
The immune system is far more active in the body than simply having an IgE reactivity. There are a number of other immunoglobulins, antibodies, which can play a role, such as IgG or IgM or even IgA. They can all play a role in the kind of disease that one might have or kind of symptoms one might have from eating a specific food. In order to determine whether this kind of a process is active, one needs only to measure the one immunoglobulin, which is most likely to be a marker of a generalized immune response to a food. For example, if a patient is showing immunological reactivity to milk, it may be an IgE reaction, in which case one has to do a blood test that measures IgE, or one can do a skin test. If one has a non-IgE reacting patient, then one has to measure the marker IgG. And measuring IgG simply tells you that there's a generalized immune response to that food, and there may be a number of players that are part of the immune armamentarium in causing his symptoms, but the single best marker of that is a blood test which measures specific IgG antibody.
I know that Dr. Sidney Baker, who was awarded the 4th Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award this last May, has done some work looking at IgG and symptoms related to food hypersensitivity. Does his work fit into the schema as you've seen it over your years of experience?
Yes, quite nicely. In fact, I'm a fan of Dr. Baker's. I've known of his work for a number of years now. He essentially did a double-blind controlled study in which he took patients who had elevated IgG levels to foods which seemed to correspond to their symptoms. He put these patients into various categories where he tried them on appropriate diets and on sham diets and then switched them over from one to the other, switched the groups over, and then at the end of the study broke the code to see under what circumstances did the patients benefit. And what he found, to a very, very large statistically significant degree, was that the patients only benefited when they were taken off the foods to which they showed specific IgG antibodies. And when he took them off foods that did not have specific IgG antibodies shown, these patients didn't benefit at all.
Let's talk a little bit about the actual testing for IgG levels, because I know that there are a variety of different clinical laboratory methods that can be used for the testing, and maybe IgG just as a generic term is not specific enough. Are there differences in the protocols, or can one always trust a laboratory IgG determined level?
When I first got into this with a company here in Mountain View, California, looking at IgG as a measure of hyperreactivity to foods, and what we found was that almost everybody has a little bit of IgG in their bloodstream, probably secondary to various episodes they've had in the past of indigestion or diarrhea or viral flu syndromes in which the intestines were involved. What we did to try to screen out the normal levels of IgG was that we went to the Stanford Blood Bank and we essentially quizzed all the donors over a period of several days and managed to collect 270 or so patient samples of people who had absolutely no illness whatever. They had no symptoms that would suggest any kind of food or any other reactivity. And we took a look at their levels and came up with very low levels of antibody, IgG, to commonly eaten foods. Then in setting up the testing that we then subsequently introduced, we drew a line and said, look, all these normals are below the level of detection for this system, so that we're not measuring normal levels. And I think if you talk to doctors who are, for whatever reason, opposed to looking at IgG as a measure of food reactivity, they will tell you, but everybody has IgG antibodies to foods, and they're correct. And what we're looking for as a measure is an elevated antibody level, and so one has to be sure that the test that you're using has done its homework and has found in that particular test how many normal patients react and how can we differentiate between normal levels and elevated levels of antibody.
When we go to the clinical manifestations of food-related reactions, are there differences in how they manifest in children versus adults? I remember seeing some papers in the pediatric literature a number of years ago that children often show proteinuria as a consequence of food reactions, whereas adults do not. So do you see clinical changes between the two?
Well, you do, and you even see differences in children depending upon how young they are. For instance, in the very young infant, you will often get projectile vomiting, for example, because of the swelling of the gastric mucosa blocking the outflow tract of the stomach. Therefore, when the stomach contracts, the infant tends to vomit upwards with some force based on that gastric contraction, to nausea symptoms, to colic in young infants, which are all part of the spasm that's induced by the inflammation in the gut wall when antibody and antigen come together, especially in infants where there's a lot of leakiness of protein materials across the gut wall, which doesn't occur later in life. As you go older and older to older and older children, you see more nasal congestion, eustachian tube dysfunction, where the ears suddenly no longer can clear the middle ear fluids, and patients now develop recurrent ear infections or can't hear as well. And sometimes this can, in fact, delay speech, the development of speech, because the child is so swollen in his ears that he doesn't hear the sounds that his parents are speaking to him very clearly, and so he can't enunciate those himself so easily. As you get older into adults, you find that it's more sophisticated and cognitive differences become more important, and other symptoms of system failure, such as the joints, become more swollen, and you see more problems with joints as you get into older age groups, and chronic diarrhea and headaches, like migraine headaches, for example, which I think are almost all caused by immune complexes from immune reactions to various foods. You do see these changing patterns depending upon age. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, very nicely. And I know you've talked much in your writings about immune complexes and how that relates to both organ-specific reactivity and also gut-associated lymphoid tissue reactivity. And assuming that the immune complexes can trigger then reactions within the immune system that release inflammatory cytokines, is there an interrelationship between, say, a low-grade allergic re-exposure and increased levels within plasma or tissues of these inflammatory mediators?
When you eat a food to which you have significant antibody levels, and if that food can go across the mucosa, the lining of the intestine, without being completely digested, then it is able, as a large protein or as a polypeptide, which is perhaps smaller than a protein but still has shape to it, those molecules can, in fact, combine with your antibody, with your IgG antibody or other, and in doing so forms an immune complex. Now, that's a normal way that the body deals with foreign material. It forms immune complexes. But then these complexes float around in the body just for very, very brief periods of time because they're very inflammatory, and the body knows that it must get rid of these, must extract them from the bloodstream, and deal with them in a different way. And what it does, it has a large number of cells that are key to removing immune complexes from the circulation. And this process happens extremely rapidly if the complexes are large enough. In fact, one pass through the liver or through the spleen, and the immune complexes are largely removed in a normal individual. The problem becomes a more disease-producing one when these scavenger cells, or macrophages as they're called, become filled, when they're no longer able to attract the immune complexes out of the circulation and the complexes continue to circulate. Then they begin to form a pattern of their own based on their own inherent properties, their chemical properties, and they tend to deposit in certain tissues, such as the joints or the walls of the blood vessels or the kidneys. Wherever they deposit, they create inflammatory conditions which then lead to illness that's focused upon that particular organ. It's interesting that we tend to make antibodies in a pattern ourselves depending upon our inherited ability to do that, and therefore we differ one from another in how we respond to a single food. Some people may develop migraines on eating that food, others may have more joint pain, while others still may develop kidney deposition and have protein in the urine and even blood in the urine, and sometimes renal failure and shutdown where the kidney scars completely and is no longer able to function and needs to be replaced. There are various consequences of immune complex deposition in tissues where they can cause illness that depends upon the overwhelming or breakdown of the body's normal system for removing these complexes successfully and, if you will, peacefully from the circulation.
There is an emerging view in the medical literature that there may be possibly etiological contribution to a variety of age-related disorders as a consequence of atypical reactions to food and food protein. I'm thinking of the correlation between gluten sensitivity and dementia and the correlation between heart disease and inflammatory mediators and food allergy, which seems to be emerging, and reactive arthritis and even possibly fatigue-related disorders like exacerbation of chronic fatigue. From your experience, have you seen clinical correlations across a variety of different ICD-9 diagnostic codes and food-related dysfunctions?
I have. It seems to me that what indeed happens is that these immune complexes will often precipitate out where there is already inflammation going on. For example, if you've had an injured knee, one knee, and you develop heavy immune complex illness, that knee that's been injured is likely to become more involved, more swollen, more painful, more hot on the touch. In other words, the arthritis becomes more intense there. I've also noticed just in my own practice that hypertension is something that yields very nicely to treatment with diet. As long as the diet is based on immune antibody levels, which are determined by these blood tests that we can do to determine what a patient is allergic to or hyperreactive to. I've now looked at behavior in children. We did a study here at Stanford, actually at the so-called Stanbridge Academy, deals with children with attention deficit disorders, and found that in virtually all the children, but very significantly in 85% of the children, a specific diet was able to improve school performance. So I think, yes, you do see unexpected benefits when you deal with the inflammatory potential of these circulating and uncontrolled immune complexes secondary to food and eating.
I presume that the diet you just described was a low allergy or an elimination type of diet that produced those benefits in the children?
Yes. What we did in that particular group, we did it as a school project and essentially worked with the patients and the children in the school setting. It takes simply a little finger stick to take a drop of blood in which we can test for the allergic foods. And then each child was given his diet. I wanted to try to run it as a double-blind controlled study, but the parents overruled me on that one because none of them wanted to have their child on a placebo. They all wanted the real diet. So what we did to try to overcome placebo effect was to extend the study for 5 months instead of looking at it after 3 or 4 weeks as we might ordinarily have done. We kept it going for 5 months because most placebo effects disappear after a month or so of treatment. And what we found at the end of 5 months is that very objectively, the children gave much better scores on their testing. These were the tests that were performed before and at the end of this study. And also the parents reported that behavior had changed, had all improved, and attention span had increased. One child, I remember, doubled her school performance from, I think, fourth grade to eighth grade level in this five-month period. And all we did was take the children off the foods that they showed elevated antibody levels to by the blood test.
You have really helped us to see that there's a connection between things like cognitive dysfunction and fatigue and maybe even myalgia-related symptoms and adverse or atypical reactions to food. Are all of those what appear to be diverse organ-specific symptoms ranging from the central nervous system to the muscles to mitochondrial effects and fatigue-related energy deficits, are they all related back, do you feel, through this immunological cascade of events that you've described?
I'm not sure that I would go so far as to suggest that the basic problem for any of these disorders is the immunological disorder. I think that more likely there is an underlying problem which is aggravated by the uncontrolled eating of foods to which the patient may have become sensitized over the years. So I think it's an aggravating situation rather than a causal.
Very interesting. I know that you have spoken in both your presentations at the symposium and your writing, and other members of your field have also commented on so-called adaptation effect, where an individual consumes a food to which they are sensitive and they feel better. And only by taking away the food and reintroducing it are the symptoms able to be seen. What is this adaptation effect? Is this the Cellier model in clinical practice of general adaptation syndrome?
Initially, the information just comes in from clinicians who work with food allergy, who say it's very interesting how very often the foods they discover the patient's allergic to are the ones that the patients are most addicted to. In looking at various fashions in which immune complexes can behave, what you find is that you can actually change the equilibrium in your body to one that is less painful if you eat more of the food. Of course, that's a temporary thing, and down the line, one is developing an indebtedness that one's going to have to pay for. But in the short haul, one can actually make himself feel better by eating more of the food to which he's allergic. And what I think is happening is that he's shifting the equilibrium, and this can be shown in animal studies to happen, is that the equilibrium in the person's body goes to what is called an antigen excess equilibrium, where the immune complexes actually get smaller. And as they're temporarily smaller, the patient feels better. So there is a mechanism in this immunology which can help us understand why we see this kind of craving for foods to which the patient is actually reacting too badly.
Very interesting. In the field of biomedical research, it appears as if there is probably no area that is changing more rapidly than clinical immunology and allergy. You, as really a senior member of the field and a person who's watched it evolve over the last few decades, undoubtedly has some view as to where we've been and where we're going. Where do you see the field moving to, and what can we look forward to as we look downstream?
Well, I think that the field has come enormous distances since I first was a postdoctoral fellow working at the research bench. By the way, I returned to Caltech to do 4 years of immunology after I received my training in pediatrics with Professor Ray Owen and Dan Campbell. And that's where I learned most of my immunology, and of course I've followed it since then and watched an enormous increase in knowledge coming from different parts of medicine. For example, people that work with transplantation have to work with that side of immunity. People that work with infectious diseases have to work with that side of it. People working with cancer, for example, are trying to use antibodies, monoclonal antibodies, for example, to treat certain kinds of cancers. And we see across the face of medicine almost every specialty now relating back to the immunology of the individual. And I think this is going to increase. Sometimes I wish there were a little bit more vision in medicine. I think there's still a tremendous inertia to accept new ideas and to adapt new ideas and processes to the clinical stage from doctors who are probably just maybe a little threatened by new ideas or feel uncertain in using these ideas in their clinical practice. I think we need to encourage doctors to look into these matters a little more and to try some of these processes, because in the long run, it's going to help our patients as we get closer to the truth about how the immune system can cause illness.
Well, Dr. Marinkovich, I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us. There's probably no clinical area of functional medicine that is more important in looking at how the environment, of which food is an important part of the environment, influences the expression of our genes. And you have very lucidly helped the listener understand this complexity of the immune system from the food-based side, from a clinical perspective, very, very well. I was told once that we eat between 25 and 30 tons of food in a lifetime, and that's all information, and that information may be friend or foe. So you've helped us to understand a little bit about how the body interprets that information that comes from our diet. We thank you very, very much for spending the time with us today and look forward to keeping up with you and your work over the next few years.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
In this month's Functional Medicine Update, we've been speaking a lot about factors that are under our control that regulate expression of genes that may be associated with premature senescence and biological aging and the loss of function. Dr. Marinkovic helped us greatly, I think, to understand this complex interrelationship between the food that we eat and the immune system that we have, and the kind of orchestration of that relationship and how food contains information and it's translated through our immune system and through the process of digestion and assimilation. We also have talked at length about the relationship that insulin and insulin balancing and insulin signaling has to that of gene expression and senescence, recognizing that insulin is more than just a glucoregulatory hormone. It also has relationships with a variety of nuclear transcription factors and the regulation of gene expression. Therefore, individuals who carry metabolic tendencies towards insulin dysfunction are individuals who may have higher risk to premature senescence, biological aging. And that certainly is borne out in the animal studies and even in the studies done with C. elegans, the nematode that I described earlier. Recently, the American Diabetes Association has published a new diagnostic criteria for diabetes, and this was in 1997, in which they were trying to make more efficient the relative screening for the increasing prevalence of type 2 diabetes, maturity onset diabetes. The fundamental changes from the 1985 WHO criteria were that there was a fall in the diagnostic plasma fasting glucose down to about 125 a milligram per deciliter from 135. A recommendation that the use of the oral glucose tolerance test be abolished, thus shifting the diagnosis exclusively to the use of fasting glucose. And the identification of a new category called impaired fasting glucose, or IFG, where the fasting plasma glucose is an intermediary range between 115 and 125 that might be considered of some intermediate hazard. Now, does that tell us about syndrome X, insulin resistance? Does that tell us about insulin resistance syndrome that might precede syndrome X? And does that interrelate well with the early stage prognostic markers of disinsulinism that correlate then with altered gene expression and functional shifts towards premature aging? Well, those are good questions, and they have been reviewed recently in The Lancet in an editorial and two accompanying papers. There is a stream of publications that has followed the announcement of the new American Diabetes Association criteria, questioning the important issues arising from this move towards the exclusive use of fasting glucose to define glucose tolerance. These issues include the effect of prevalence and phenotype and ability of the pre-diabetic state to predict diabetes and cardiovascular disease, because as we know, the biggest risk to mortality in the type 2 diabetic is not diabetes itself, but rather cardiovascular disease mortality, which comes concomitant as a consequence of the molecular etiology and pathogenesis of type 2 diabetes. Most studies have compared the American Diabetics Association with the WHO criteria with the endpoint as diabetes, rather than with the endpoint as cardiovascular risk or as disinsulinism, the effects on insulin. Among people with diabetes, according to the ADA criteria, only 46% had 2-hour postprandial glucose concentrations that met the WHO 2-hour glucose criteria. So they often suggest that the routine use of the oral glucose tolerance test is not specific enough for picking up diabetes, and therefore would be overutilization to use this test. And therefore they have dropped it in lieu of using a lowered fasting blood sugar cutoff. There is evidence, however, that the impaired fasting glucose is not as sensitive as impaired glucose tolerance, which can only be measured through the glucose tolerance test, as a predictor both of type 2 diabetes and, more importantly, the endpoint of cardiovascular risk. The sensitivities being 26% for impaired fasting glucose and 50% for impaired glucose tolerance. Well, in this particular issue of The Lancet, they go on to say, when you examine the DECODE study — the DECODE study is a very large diabetes epidemiology study. DECODE, D-E-C-O-D-E, stands for Diabetes Epidemiology, Collaborative Analysis of Diagnostic Criteria in Europe. Everybody has to have their abbreviation, don't they? That's become a kind of an interesting feature of medical studies in the last few years, is these abbreviations. But the DECODE study is a very large review of individuals with diabetes, looking at their clinical condition in a variety of countries, including France and Finland, Denmark, Netherlands, Sweden, Italy, and England, and Malta, examining the prevalence of various factors of diabetes and how that interrelates with the 75-gram oral glucose tolerance test versus a fasting blood sugar, and looking at 2-hour postprandial sugars after the oral glucose load, and trying to make some determination as to what the relative precision and sensitivity of these different measurements are. Well, the first study was entitled Glucose Tolerance and Mortality, Comparison of WHO and American Diabetes Association Diagnostic Criteria. In this study, the investigators found from the DECODE data that fasting glucose concentrations alone do not identify individuals at increased risk of death associated with hyperglycemia. The oral glucose tolerance test provides additional prognostic information and enables detection of individuals with impaired glucose tolerance who have the greatest attributable risk to death, which comes as a consequence of cardiovascular disease. That's followed up in a companion study, actually from the Division of Endocrinology at Kaiser Permanente of Georgia and the Tucker Division of Endocrinology at Emory Medical School. This paper is entitled Cardiovascular Disease in Older Adults with Glucose Disorders, and again, comparing the American Diabetes Association criteria versus the WHO criteria. And in this particular study, again, they find that fasting ADA criteria for blood sugar were less sensitive than the WHO criteria that included oral glucose tolerance test, 2-hour postprandial blood sugars, for predicting cardiovascular disease among individuals' abnormal glucose management, sensitivity being 28% for glucose alone and 54% for the inclusion of the glucose tolerance test. Therefore, I think we need to be very cautious when applying the ADA criteria to a functional medicine perspective on dysinsulinism and dysglycemia. These are maybe two different things that we're looking for. The ADA criteria is probably fine if you're trying to pick up diabetes. It may not, however, be sensitive enough to pick up the relative propensity towards dysinsulinism that then associates itself with gene expression functional changes and with phenotypic shifts then towards diseases that may range from cardiovascular disease to cancer to inflammatory disorders to even dementia, the amyloidosis, and maybe even some of the oxidative stress neuronal injuries that are associated with dysinsulinism. The important point of this series of studies is to ask the question, what are we really trying to answer? What is the question we're trying to answer? Are we just trying to form a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, or are we trying to look at the functional changes in an individual that have shifted them towards premature biological aging, associated in this case with dysinsulinism? If it's the latter that we're interested in answering, then we need to do more than just measure fasting blood sugar with a new lower cutoff. We need to be looking at insulin responsiveness, and therefore the 2-hour postprandial glucose and insulin levels may be very important as a prognostic tool, along with fructosamine or with hemoglobin A1C or hemoglobin AGE, advanced glycosylation end products, to look at this whole glycosylation component of non-enzymatic glycosylation associated with dysinsulinism. Let me, if I can, then move from that. Let's say we've identified an individual who has dysglycemia and dysinsulinism, and we're trying to normalize their insulin sensitivity. So this would be an individual that is on the way towards being a type 2 diabetic. Well, recently a very nice clinical pilot study was published in the journal Free Radical Biology and Medicine, volume 27, page 309, looking at the effect of orally administered racemic alpha-lipoic acid and its ability to influence insulin sensitivity in patients with type 2 diabetes. This was actually a very interesting study using 600 milligrams, 1200 milligrams, and 1800 milligrams per day of alpha-lipoic acid as a racemic form, the synthetic DL mixture, against a placebo control. And it was found that the 600 milligram per day dose did just about as well as either the 1200 or the 1800 milligram per day dose. It had about a 60% improvement clearance rate for glucose as contrasted to the placebo that only had about a 25% improvement. So there was a significant improvement in glucose clearance through improving insulin sensitivity by the administration of 600 milligrams of racemic lipoate per day. Now, it's important to note that the body uses really only one enantiomer of the lipoic acid. It doesn't use both the DNL or RNS forms. preclinical data suggests that the natural enantiomer, which is R plus alpha-lipoic acid, which is only half of the racemic alpha-lipoic acid, is responsible for the metabolic action in improving insulin sensitivity and glucose removal. The non-natural enantiomer, which is the S minus alpha-lipoic, has even been shown to have maybe antagonistic effects. So you get some retardation of the improvement by including the racemic mixture. Therefore, the clinical effect is really maximized when you use the natural R plus alpha-lipoic and not the synthetic RS racemic mixture. As I mentioned, the S minus has antagonistic effects because it appears to downregulate glucose transporters and therefore might even increase hyperinsulinemia. So although the study was done with the racemic, the best would be to use the natural enantiomer of alpha-lipoic acid. We know that vitamin E also has a positive impact on improving insulin sensitivity in individuals with type 2 diabetes. We've talked about that in previous functional medicine updates. And a recent interesting paper did appear in Diabetes Care, Volume 22, page 1245 in 1999, talking about high-dose vitamin E supplementation normalizing retinal blood flow and creatinine clearance in patients with, in this case, type 1 diabetes. And in this particular paper, what they used is a very high dose of vitamin E, about 1,800 IUs per day, against a placebo for 4 months in type 1 diabetics and looking at retinal damage and retinal blood flow, and showed in this case a positive improvement in retinal blood flow and creatinine clearance was reduced in patients with type 1 diabetes, suggesting that the secondary side effects of the disease and nephropathy and ocular pathology were both reduced by increasing therapeutic doses of vitamin E. Well, that's a very interesting emerging story around the whole insulin sensitivity, disinsulinism area, and its relationship to senescence, the turning on and turning off of genes. And remember the C. elegans work on the nematode that showed there was a tight correlation between this insulin control genes and senescence of the animal that's been seen in many other animal species that have been studied. So this may be a principle that's associated with biological aging across many species. Another that we've spoken to, obviously, is this whole chronic inflammation. And where we might first focus some of our interest in chronic inflammation could be the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. As you know, we have spoken at length in Functional Medicine Update about a program designed to help normalize gut function in individuals that have chronic gut dysbiosis or dysfunction or chronic inflammation. We have termed it the 4R program, and that stands for remove, replace, reinoculate, and repair. That program has been used now by thousands of clinicians successfully around the world. I think is a very interesting nomogram for reminding ourselves about the importance of starting with the gut in balancing the immune system, knowing that more than 50% of our immune system is clustered around the gastrointestinal tract. Well, what about ulcerative colitis and localized inflammatory conditions of the gut? How do we introduce the 4R program in those cases? Well, one interesting paper has been published recently in this that speaks again to the power of this 4R approach. And the title of this paper is from The Lancet is Non-Pathogenic E. coli versus Mesalazine for the Treatment of Ulcerative Colitis. Now, this is pretty remarkable. It turns out that there is a paper that was published in 1989 in The Lancet, which I went back and relooked at by Bennett and Brinkman, entitled Treatment of Ulcerative Colitis with Implantation of Normal Colonic Flora. And when you look at the experimental procedure in there, they were able to reduce serious ulcerative colitis in its severity and start healing by instilling flora from people who did not have ulcerative colitis. And the way they did this, and I know this sounds kind of gassy, you have to read the experimental section, they took the feces of individuals who did not have ulcerative colitis. They made an enema out of it and instilled it then into the rectum of the individuals with ulcerative colitis. And they were able to greatly reduce the inflammation and start the process of healing by instilling an enema containing the feces from non-ulcerative colitis individuals. This was the Lancet 1989, page 164, for those of you who want to follow through with that Brinkman paper. Since then, other investigators have been actively involved in following up on this, and that's the most recent paper in the Lancet that I'm describing and citing, volume 354, page 635 in 1999. And what they did is they gave an oral preparation, in this case, enterically coated capsules of purified E. coli that were non-pathogenic. So they had cultured these from the stools of individuals without ulcerative colitis, and then they had taken these non-pathogenic E. coli, encapsulated them and enterically coated them so they could survive through the digestive system, and looked at the impact that it had in a single-center randomized double-blind study with 120 patients with ulcerative colitis. 116 patients accepted to be involved in the protocol, 59 were randomized to the mesalazine, which is the standard treatment, and 57 to E. coli oral supplementation. All patients received standard medical therapy together with a one-week course of oral gentamicin. After remission, patients were maintained on either mesalazine or E. coli and followed for a maximum of 12 months. It's quite remarkable, the results. 44 or 75% of the patients in the mesalazine group attained remission compared with 68% in the E. coli group, meaning they were comparable within range of statistical significance. The re-inoculation of the gut with bacteria was as effective as giving mesalazine in these patients. Now, this is quite remarkable because it appears as if a short course of antibiotics followed by an administration of oral E. coli of these non-pathogenic form may in fact be as beneficial as long-term administration with mesalazine, which has, as you know, some adverse potential side effects. There are several possible mechanisms the authors suggest may describe how this works, how the non-pathogenic E. coli strain has an effect. First, as we've said in past discussions, the E. coli may be blocking receptors in the intestinal mucosa and thus prevent adhesion of the pathogenic bacteria from becoming established. Secondly, the E. coli strain, which shows antagonistic activity against a variety of pathogenic and non-pathogenic enterobacteria due to the production of bacteriocins or microcins, may have eliminated other pathogenic bacteria just by competitive exclusion through their production of their own pathogenic substances. Third, the growth and the metabolic activity of E. coli may have caused changes in the pH or chemical composition of the colonic lumen that are unfavorable to bacteria involved in the pathogenesis of ulcerative colitis, or promote the repair and nourishment of the mucosa. This is our last R, isn't it? The repair phase. The manipulation, therefore, of colonic bacteria with antibiotics and probiotic agents may prove more effective and better tolerated than immunosuppressant drugs in the future. And I quote from the end of that particular statement. So I think what we're witnessing is, again, the emergence of continuing medical support of the 4R approach for a variety of immunologically related dysfunctions that start in the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. It's, I think, quite exciting that we started talking about this in 1990 and really looking into the effect of the 4R program across a wide range of chronic health problems. And now we're seeing more and more that this is starting to be defined as clinically reasonable and may be the method of choice in many cases. Well, what about Candida albicans? There's another interesting chronic gastrointestinal mucosal problem. Another really interesting breakthrough has occurred in this area, which I would just give to you as an early read. I don't think we can read too much into the clinical implications of this yet, but in Science Magazine, a very interesting paper was published within the last few months, volume 285, page 578, entitled "An Adhesion of the Yeast Pathogen Candida glabrata in Mediating Adherence to Human Epithelial Cells." And what they did is a very sophisticated molecular biological approach towards looking at the adherence of Candida glabrata to mucosal cells and show that the adhesion or adherence was related to lectins on the surface of the yeast that would bind to cell surface receptors on the mucosal cells. And then if you could disrupt that particular carbohydrate lectin binding, that you could then prevent adherence, which then would protect against proliferation and infection. And they actually even defined the domain of that particular lectin and where it was in the gene and what its composition was. It was a specific N-acetyl-lactosamine on the surface of the candida. And by modifying that binding, they could prevent then the adherence and therefore the proliferation of candida. Therefore, again, as part of the 4R program, I think we should be looking at ways of disturbing and interrupting and blocking the adherence of these organisms like Candida albicans, Candida glabrata, that can produce then intestinal dysbiosis. And that can occur by a variety of chemical jamming substances or blocking substances that interfere with the lectin binding domains. And that might have a lot to do with the kind of carbohydrates we eat and the kind of lectin-containing foods that we eat, which then either introduce or prevent the adherence of various bacteria and fungi to the gastrointestinal mucosal binding site. We'll be talking more about that in future discussions. Lastly, I want to leave you with an interesting thought about hepatitis C. Hepatitis C, as you know, is the most common cause of viral hepatitis in the United States. Epidemiological studies by the CDC have shown that as many as 4 million Americans might be chronically infected. And in the world at large, it's a very, very serious problem, with maybe 6% of selected populations in various developing countries having this difficulty. It leads to liver injury and ultimate cirrhosis. It can lead, clearly, to increased risk to liver cancer. And a recent paper in the American Journal of Gastroenterology, volume 94, page 2003, is entitled Hepatocellular Mitochondrial Alterations in Patients with Chronic Hepatitis C, Ultrastructural and Biochemical Findings. This is a very, very interesting paper in light of everything we've talked about this month in Functional Medicine Update, because it goes on to say that mitochondrial dysfunction or failure is an important factor in the cytotoxicity of hepatitis C infection, and in fact may cause the cell to undergo premature cell death, the hepatic cell, by increasing apoptotic cell death. The mitochondrial dysfunction would be expected to lead to oxygen radical formation and lipid peroxidation. The activation of a gene FAS has also been found to cause cellular glutathione depletion, which is seen in patients that have hepatitis C infection. Thus, many observations could in part be explained by the FAS-mediated cytotoxicity, upregulating oxidative stress, mitochondrial injury associated with a shift of redox in the hepatic cell towards an oxidative-mediated pathway. So what do you do about that clinically? They go on to suggest, and I'm now quoting from Barbero and et al. In the paper, that antioxidants may clearly be of benefit and provide protection from mitochondrial injury mediated by the oxidative stress with the hepatitis C infection. This is supported by a pilot study of hepatitis C virus-infected patients who were treated with high-dose vitamin E, who showed an improvement in their aminotransferase levels with a lowering of potentially of liver damage. As mitochondrial injury leads to apoptosis, capsaicin inhibitors could block the effective mechanisms leading to apoptosis and thus be able to ameliorate cellular injury. And therefore, alpha-lipoic acid, vitamin E, N-acetylcysteine, and coenzyme Q10, those mitochondrial resuscitate nutrients that we've talked about so many times, may play a very important role in Hep C and prevention of hepatotoxicity. Well, I think that's probably enough for 1 month in Functional Medicine Update. Gives us some, quote, food for thought. And we'll look forward to continuing this theme as we move into, believe it or not, the last month of this century, the December 1999 issue. See you next month.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.